For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know something is wrong, and it's time to stand up. You are listening to the John Age Show.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
You found it. You're here. You're headlong down the runaway train that is the Anomic Age, and I am your humble host, John Age. Happy to be back with you once again. And ain't even the wee hours of the AM yet. We're still in the evening hours. I guess maybe sort of 8:46 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, coming at you from the formerly great state of North Carolina. Thanks for being with us this fine day, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being with us. Check out AnomicAge.com. If you've not already done so, please share those links. Friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. I'm kind of new to Instagram, so if you happen to be on there, give me a follow, give me a like. Also, back on Twitter after a huge hiatus. I think it was like 3 years or more. I don't know, 3.5. Anyway, back on Twitter, so please do the same. Like all the likes, subscribe to all the subscriptions. You can also find me on Brighteon, BitChute, Rumble, Odyssey, Facebook, Telegram, and that too. So you can do that all for free, just like you're listening to the show for nada. But if you want to help me out, paypal.me/AnomicAge, patreon.com/AnomicAge as well. That would help me oh so much. It would. It really would. I'm not kidding. So if you could be a patron, that would give me some regular quine. If you'd like to make a one-time donation, you can do that also. So please do so. Hold on. We got a second Ohio train derailment. Yeah. I just flew in on the... I didn't fly in. Came in on a message. So nevertheless, I'm not going to get into any derailments this evening. But paypal.me/AnomicAge, patreon.com/AnomicAge as well. Like all the likes, subscribe to all the subscriptions. We got the iPhone app, the Android app, the subscribe by email link. Whew. What else we got down there? That's about it. Free newsletter. Shoot me some Satoshis via Lightning link also. I haven't got any Satoshis. So if you want to shoot me some of this digital currency, that's cool. Between you and me and the NSA, I would rather have the regular PayPal or Patreon. But what do I know? Anyway, we're not going to get into any of that this evening. We are a mere 3 minutes and 50 seconds in, and we have not yet discussed what I want to discuss. The main topic of the hour, it won't be an hour, folks. I'll try to keep this one trim, slim, and around 30 minutes, I guess. Tonight, we're going to get into the linguistic warfare. The title of this episode this evening is Semantical Sabotage. I thought about naming it Semantical Saboteurs, because there's a lot of people that are saboteurs of the language out there. So we'll get into that just a little bit. So let's break things down a little bit. So much to get into, but we'll try to work with it. Semantics is the study of meanings. So I'm titling this one Semantical Saboteurs because I think that's exactly what's been going on. There's been a whole lot of semantical changes, sabotage that's been going on. And this is not a recent incarnation, as you might have thought. It's been going on for quite a long time. But the semantics of things, the meanings of things have definitely changed. You can look at a dictionary from right about now and look at one from about 50 years ago, and you will, of course, see some subtle changes. I mean, along with just complete idiotic words like bling being added to the dictionary, the actual meaning, the semantics have definitely changed. Also, I'm not even going to get into the other things like Black's Law Dictionary and the Fringe on the Flag and all that. I'm not going to delve down that rabbit hole this evening. I'm just going to talk about the pure, everyday, regular old English-speaking language and the semantics that have definitely changed in that regard. Another thing I want to really get into is how this piggybacks, ties in, connects, and otherwise colludes with the acquiescence of the general public. The acquiescence, in case you were wondering. Here we go. Let's trouble check. To quote Barney Fife, the acquiescence, the passive acceptance or submission, the act of acquiescing or state of being acquiescent. Woo, man, we're talking all kinds of linguistics now, folks. So a lot of people are probably plugging into this right about now and going, what? What does this have to do with acquiescence? What is this linguistic warfare, the changing of meanings, definitions, and semantics have to do with anything as far as the general public looking like a bunch of sedate garden gnomes right about now? Nothing going on. Nothing, folks. Nothing. Hopefully going to have some guests on. Well, we already had one this week. We're going to have a few more next week getting into what's going on across the pond. Across the pond. We'll get into one of my guests coming from England, and we'll get into Mr. Michael Yan. I don't think he'd mind me saying somewhere in Europe right about now. So we'll try to get into both of those guests next week and so much more, so please tune in. But back to the semantics, the meaning of things, how the meaning has changed and how that affects how the populace acts. And this is definitely a full frontal assault, but also it's a bit of a pincer attack. It's on all fronts, folks. We are being attacked on all fronts. But tonight it's just going to be the linguistic side of things, how the meanings have changed. And we'll connect into some anthropology, sociology, and linguistics, too. So this has been going on for well over 100 years. That's why they had linguistic psychologists, linguistic anthropologists, and all these different types of social science individuals playing into this. I've touched on the notion of Project Camelot, which was in the 1960s, which was how various social science departments, or I suppose scientists from the social science departments, were being pulled in and their research being used to add that to the battlefield. It was, of course, first being used in Latin America, Central America, South America, that sort of thing. And then they were going to begin using it in Vietnam and the like. So when we saw Project Camelot in the 1960s, this was not anything new. I mentioned this on a previous episode that the British had been doing this for hundreds of years. So when they went to conquer, take over, and otherwise colonize various spots on the globe, they would indefinitely, undoubtedly, indubitably put in anthropologists, or even before anthropologists were a thing, they would put in scientists on the social variety, of course, to figure out how to better take over. How can we get the general people to better acquiesce to what we want? In other words, how can we get them to give us all their stuff for next to nothing? So this is not a new phenomenon, but it's been going on globally for quite some time. It's been going on in theaters of war for quite some time. And as all things do, the chickens have come home to roost in this country for at least the past 100 years, where they have, of course, used linguistic warfare or semantical sabotage to change the meanings of things and to confuse the public. So we'll get you in the Wayback Machine, and we'll talk about the Sapir-Whorf Hypothesis. Finally, all that anthropological knowledge is being put to good use on this show. So the Sapir-Whorf Hypothesis, that was first and foremost by Edward Sapir, student of Franz Boas, of course, the father of American anthropology. And Edward Sapir was a proponent of a bit of linguistic determinism. He was saying that language is a symbolic guide to the culture. And his student, Benjamin Whorf, was pushing sort of the same thing. And it's like all these famous dead guys do. They sort of build on the predecessor and remix, repackage, reconstitute that theory and up the ante a little bit with their own twist on it. Benjamin Whorf was definitely saying language is deterministic of thought. So the student and the teacher, those two merged into the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And both of them were studying the phenomenon of language shaping one's thoughts. The idea that the construct of language, meaning very complex language, fosters more complex thought, and more simplistic language, more simplistic thought. I'm definitely sort of condensing this down quite a bit and giving you very broad strokes, so I would recommend researching this quite a bit more. But the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis was linguistic determinism of sorts, saying just that. The way you think, or excuse me, the language you use can control the way you think. So they were looking at the complexity of colors within cultures, how some cultures of the more traditional, foraging, or dare I say primitive, because you can't say that anymore, right? Those cultures had a more limited language and thus a more limited color palette. And to compare and contrast on the opposite end of that pendulum, you would have very complex cultures that have a more complex linguistic palette, having far more descriptive terms for color. If you look into a more contemporary BBC documentary, it was covering the Himba people of northern Namibia, and it was just chronicling how they didn't really have a word for blue, if I'm not mistaken. They had green and a few others, but they didn't have blue, so to speak. And that was really just sort of replicating a bit of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis and studies that had been done almost 100 years ago. So I get you. If you're reading into that, especially that BBC documentary, you'll see a lot saying, oh, it's just hogwash and it's limited and the study wasn't right. And yeah, you see the same sort of fodder thrown at the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis as well. So take it for what you will. Bottom line is they were saying that language can control thoughts. And of course, we know that thought can control actions. So if you have got an ever-changing, and I'm not talking about changing as far as just adding or detracting a little bit here and there from the language. I'm talking about reshaping or redefining terms in the language. Not just influx in the biological realm, but sort of completely changing language and what language means. So if you can do that, if you can change the language, you can obviously probably apply that multi-generationally. So you could say we can change the language subtly over multiple generations, and thus in doing so, you guessed it, folks, change the way that people think. And keep in mind, this is just one spoke on the wheel. This is not talking about the education system, the food, the water, the air, toxification of all the above, the plethora, I mean, just the pantheon of media. I'm talking about just this one little spoke on the wheel, the language itself being changed. Because everything else I just mentioned is just, it's just a mechanism for that change. Hence the bling bling that is just pure nonsensical gibberish that's been, of course, adopted into our lexicon here in the West. That's just one of many, but just a stupid example, I assure you. So what this is really doing is it's changing the way people think. It's changing their linguistic meanings of words, terms, and phrases. So all this is subtly changing the thought processes of the general public. It's turning us from a once strong, vital society that would be quick to challenge tyranny into a very subservient society that is all too quick to acquiesce to tyranny. So we'll take you down the rabbit hole a little bit and just discuss how things have linguistically changed. I like to pick on one of the obvious ones here, Edward Bernays' nephew. You guessed it. I'm sorry, not, it's Edward Bernays' nephew, a faux pas. Edward Bernays, the gentleman that wrote Propaganda, as well as the predecessor of Crystallizing Public Opinion. Yeah. That's old Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew. Yeah, cigar is just a cigar, right? Or is it? But I digress. Edward Bernays, crystallizing public opinion and his second there, propaganda, really laid this out in the early 1900s. And that was, of course, used for torches of freedom. It was, of course, used to standardize, normalize, and subsidize. The pork industry and the orange juice industry is making these staples within breakfast. And all sort of subtleties that you might not know unless you really delve into this gentleman. How he indeed did change our society by subtle use of propaganda. And also by subtle use of linguistics. You see, he was also the one that was responsible for changing the Department of War to the Department of Defense. A little after World War II, they decided, okay, well, it's not the Department of War anymore. Excuse me. It's now the Department of Defense. So prior to that, they each branch of the military was answering to their own military secretary, so to speak. And now we have just the Secretary of Defense. Not anymore. No more just answering to individuals. Now it's more standardized under one big umbrella branch. And of course, it's more palatable for the general public to call it defense than that Department of War. That sounds also spooky, doesn't it? So thanks to Edward Bernays, that was, of course, changed. But we see that in our current society where they have definitely, I will just say, wussified the general public into using more palatable terms. Pinkies out, ladies and gentlemen. Pinkies out. Much more palatable terms to describe everyone. So no longer could you be called fat. Oh, my goodness, it might hurt someone's feelings. Now you're just going to have to be called husky or big boned or, I guess, what's that Lizzo creature? Oh, so beautiful. Oh, Lizzo's just gorgeous, right? So you're not fat anymore. You could be something else, but you can't dare say fat because it might be fat shaming. Can't do that. Oh, you can't say skinny anymore either. You got to say slender or sleek, flaco, right? You can't say skinny. I'm joking there, Spanish folks, flaco. Anyway, so yeah, you can't say that anymore either. And of course, now they have kicked the can all the way down the road until we have a litany of new pronouns that we have to address each other by because, again, you can't offend anyone, right? Can't call someone the wrong thing. And for me, I mean, this kind of was rooted in social sciences as well, where everywhere now you see this term gender thrown around, gender, gender, gender. And they conflate the term gender with sex. So for me, in social science land, I always kind of look at it like this. Sex is what you're born with. It's the XX or the XY chromosome that makes you either male or female. Now, this is true whether or not you're talking about a wildebeest, a frog, a raccoon, or a human. It's the same old song, folks. All around the world, it's the same song. So your sex is that. Gender, on the other hand, is this stupid, moronic reality that we live in now. So just to be clear, it's not a gender reveal. It's a sex reveal, folks. It's sex. Bottom line, that's it. That's all. There is nothing more. It's called the sex chromosome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the last one there in your 46 chromosomes. Your last one there is your 46th, your sex chromosome. Mm-hmm. It's not your gender chromosome. That's just a bunch of boulder dash that mentally ill people fight about. That's all. So back to the drawing board. That's one of these new terms that they've conflated, added to, and otherwise changed that has changed the mentality of the, specifically here in the West, the American people. So all this is linguistic warfare. It is semantical sabotage. We have changed these terms over the years. You see, once upon a time, being masculine was a good thing. And now we've arranged it to be called toxic. And toxic masculinity. You can't be masculine now, can you? Same thing with feminine. Feminine was once upon a time a good thing. Now it's a detractor, or at least it is by many of the mentally ill troglodytes that parade around this formerly great nation. So all things that once were good have now been bastardized and turned into, metamorphosized in to something completely different. And this whole thing transcends even just the language, because the language can determine the thoughts, and the thought can determine the actions. So therefore, this really does explain quite a bit of why you see these mentally depraved people all too willing to riot, burn down, assault, rape, murder, and pillage in cities all across the nation during this whole Summer of Rage thing a few years back. And you're seeing the same thing right about now in the in Atlanta area. I might get into that in another episode this evening. And you see these same sort of redefining of points and redefining of thoughts. And what this really is a grooming, people. It is a multi-generational grooming. And now I believe in this current generation, we're seeing it as just a unigenerational grooming mechanism. Because if you can get someone to accept one lie, they'll be more likely to acquiesce to the next lie. And there comes a point, crossing the Rubicon, the point of no return, if you will, to where you've accepted so much of the lie that you can't really turn back. Well, you can, and you should. But it's very hard, once you've bought into a complete lie for so long, to really admit to yourself, come clean with the fact that it is a lie, and then go out amongst your peers, aka the general public, and admit that it was a big lie. Especially your peers, your peer group, your social circle, that really doesn't really transcend all that much as far as changing from the point of adolescence to the point of you're going to die. I mean, you might think it would, but sadly enough, I mean, that peer group, that inner circle, your friends, yeah, they have just as much sway and control over you as an adult as they once did as an adolescent. So if your friends think, oh my goodness, John has flipped his lid, he's lost his marbles, you know, because he actually thinks that this whole drag queen story thing's a bad idea. Oh my goodness. What is he actually thinks that men are men and women are women? Oh my goodness gracious, I guess he even thinks that only women can birth children? My goodness, he must be depraved. So you see how this is working, folks? And this really manifests in a number of different ways. Let me see if I can pull some more fuel to the fire up here for you, because I know someone's not quite getting it. Because I want to throw in some more here. This is the Bitterman coercion chart. Albert Bitterman did a lot of early work in the Korean War with POWs coming back, and basically why they revealed secrets and why they didn't. And his coercion chart went on to be used by the U.S. Army. It was uncovered again in the early 1970s. If I'm not sure, I'm mistaken here. Who is this one? I think it tells me in the URL, doesn't it? Or maybe it doesn't. I swear I thought it did. Amnesty International, that's who it was, in the 70s that uncovered the Bitterman coercion chart, again being used by the armed forces at large, not just the Army anymore. And then, of course, in the early 2000s, the Bitterman coercion chart surfaced again, being used at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So that would be the Bitterman coercion chart by Albert Bitterman. He was definitely a psychologist, went on to do all kinds of government-type work, and published this first in the late 1950s and again in the 60s at a conference, and it snowballed from there. So I mention this to connect dots as to how this Bitterman coercion chart has been used unknowingly. You might not know this chart, but it's been done to you. So if you look at things like Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, they were using the Bitterman coercion chart. They were using these mechanisms of isolation. Let me throw it up here one more time and roll through it. Isolation, monopolization of perception, humiliation and degradation, exhaustion, threats, occasional indulgences. Oh, you might get to take off your mask here and there. Demonstrating omnipotence. Oh, we can see you everywhere. And forcing trivial demands. Trivial demands like wearing your mask in this place of business. You got to wear your mask. So you've seen this of course, in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. I would bet the bank that you're seeing this in those D.C. jails where the January 6th people are being held for years now, over well over 100 people being held without trial, without just anything that is covered by the Constitution. That's why I've said this from day one. This is Guantanamo North, D.C. Guantanamo. Guantanamo here in the District of Criminals, right outside of McLean, Virginia. That's where this is. This ain't some faraway land. This is not in the Middle East. This is not horrible North Korea. This is the land of the sheep, the home of the slave, where this is happening 8 days a week and twice on Sunday. It is the Bitterman coercion chart. It is the acquiescence. It is the linguistic warfare. So how is all this playing out linguistic warfare-wise, semantical sabotaging on our daily lives? Well, they've used this over and over again and again and again. Most notably, they've used this with PSYOP 19. Every single thing I ran through with the Bitterman coercion chart when I first covered it at the beginning of PSYOP 19 is being done right now. Every single bit of this is semantical manipulation. Getting you to call torture, it's not torture anymore. You see, everything in that Bitterman coercion chart was used by the communists in Korea as torture mechanism. It was also used by the other communist organizations, whether or not you're talking the Khmer Rouge, whether or not you're talking Mao, Hitler, Mussolini, Lenin, Stalin, the like. These were the methods of torture. But we were convinced that this is no longer torture through that semantical sabotage because, oh, how can it be torture if we're doing it in Guantanamo? How can it still be torture if we're doing it to the American people in D.C.? Remember that black ops site where they were taking people that popped up on the scope about 5 years ago and it was never seen again? It was a black site in Chicago, Illinois, that they were taking people off the street and running these same similar ops. But they've conditioned you to think, well, it can't be torture. Now, can it? Because they've redefined torture. Every single thing you saw from the Bitterman coercion chart was used on you during PSYOP 19. But you were conditioned and thought through the semantical warfare that this can't be torture. Well, we're forcing you to stay in your house. Well, we're forcing you with these trivial demands to walk in this specific line in the store. Well, we're forcing you to wear this slave shackle, aka the mask. And then we're forcing you, after they got done with all that nonsense, they knew that you were ripe for the picking and you would easily acquiesce to the vaccine, the gene therapy that would kill you. Sudden death? Anyone? SADS, sudden adult death syndrome? Anyone? Is this ringing a bell yet, folks? This is all linguistic warfare. This is semantical sabotage. They've convinced us of all this. The language affecting the mental affecting the behavior. This is all like a nesting doll effect. And this is not happenstance. This is not a sudden, just rare occurrence that just came out of the clear blue sky. They have been running these ops, testing these ops, and actuarying out these ops for quite some time. And in the last, I'd say, 20 years or so, they have been going live with these various ops from the 90s all the way up until today. Good grief, we're up 30-plus years of this nonsense. Easy. Will you believe this? Waco, Ruby Ridge. Will you believe that? Pulse Nightclub, Sandy Hook. Will you believe that? JFK, 9/11. It's subtle nudging. Will you believe this story? Okay. You believe that story, you bunch of boobs. I bet you'll believe this one too. Same thing with this actuarying out of this. Will you just wear your mask and walk in this specific line? Well, boy, you're a big sucker. How about you take this death shot? Sound good? So, whether you know it or not, what you have been under for quite some time is various ops, various stages of the ops. And this is only one spoke in the wheel. It is semantical sabotage. It is linguistic warfare. It is convincing you through the language to change your mental, which will change your actions. And that definitely adds up and comes out as an even number as to why we're seeing these nutbags assault people and cut things off and staple things on and have all sorts of idiotic attire and scream and rant and rave and demand you call them a thee, they, them, and all this nonsense. It's warfare, folks. It is warfare on the linguistic level, which is affecting the mental and the physical. Just one spoke in the wheel. You can't do everything, but you can do something. Be safe out there. I'll be seeing you sooner than later in the Anomic Age.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm gonna go get some more money.